"What is it?" asked Ivan Ilyich with a smile, encouraged by this sign of life.
"Ivan Kostenkinich here makes me laugh," she answered, looking down.
The general distinguished indeed a flaxen-headed young man, exceedingly good-looking, who was sitting on a chair at the other end of the sofa, whispering something to Madame Pseldonimov. The young man stood up. He was apparently very young and very shy.
"I was telling the lady about a dream book, Your Excellency," he muttered, as though apologizing.
"About what sort of dream book?" asked Ivan Ilyich condescendingly.
"There is a new dream book, a literary one. I was telling the lady that to dream of Mr. Panaev means spilling coffee on one's shirt front."
"What innocence," thought Ivan Ilyich with positive annoyance. Though the young man flushed very red as he said it, he was incredibly delighted that he had said this about Mr. Panaev. "To be sure, I have heard of it," responded His Excellency.
"No, there is something better than that," said a voice quite close to Ivan Ilyich. "There is a new encyclopedia being published, and they say Mr. Kraevsky will write articles and satirical literature."
This was said by a young man who was by no means embarrassed, but rather free and easy. He was wearing gloves and a white waistcoat, and carried a hat in his hand. He did not dance, and looked condescending, for he was on the staff of a satirical paper called The Firebrand, and gave himself airs accordingly. He had come casually to the wedding, invited as an honoured guest of the Pseldonimovs, with whom he was on intimate terms, and with whom, only a year before, he had lived in very poor lodgings, kept by a German woman. He drank vodka, however, and for that purpose had more than once withdrawn to a snug little back room to which all the guests knew their way. The general disliked him extremely.
"And the reason that's funny," broke in joyfully the flaxen-headed young man who had talked of the shirt front, and at whom the young man on the comic paper looked with hatred in consequence, "it's funny, Your Excellency, because it is supposed by the writer that Mr. Kraevsky does not know how to spell, and thinks that satirical ought to be written with a Y instead of an I."
But the poor young man scarcely finished his sentence. He could see from his eyes that the general knew all this long ago, for the general himself looked embarrassed, and evidently because he knew it. The young man seemed inconceivably ashamed. He succeeded in effacing himself completely, and remained very melancholy all the rest of the evening. But to make up for that, the young man on the staff of the Firebrand came up nearer, and seemed to be intending to sit down somewhere close by. Such free and easy manners struck Ivan Ilyich as rather shocking.
"Tell me, please, Porfiry," he began, in order to say something. "Why, I have always wanted to ask you about it in person. Why are you called Pseldonimov instead of Pseudonimov? Your name surely must be Pseudonimov."
"I cannot inform you exactly, Your Excellency," said Pseldonimov.
"It must have been that when his father went into the service, they made a mistake in the papers, so that he has remained now Pseldonimov," put in Akim Petrovich. "That does happen."
"Undoubtedly," the general said with warmth, "undoubtedly. For only think, Pseudonimov comes from the literary word pseudonym, while Pseldonimov means nothing."
"Due to foolishness," added Akim Petrovich.
"You mean what is due to foolishness?"
"The Russian common people in their foolishness often alter letters, and sometimes pronounce them in their own way. For instance, they say Nevalid instead of Invalid."
"Oh yes, Nevalid."
"Mumba, too, they say, Your Excellency," boomed out the tall officer, who had long been itching to distinguish himself in some way.
"What do you mean by mumba?"
"Mumba instead of number, Your Excellency."
"Oh, yes, mumba instead of number, to be sure, to be sure." Ivan Ilyich had to do a chuckle for the benefit of the officer, too. The officer straightened his tie.
"Another thing they say is nigh by," the young man on the comic paper put in. but His Excellency tried not to hear this. His chuckles were not at everybody's disposal.
"Nigh by instead of near," the young man on the comic paper persisted, in evident irritation. Ivan Ilyich looked at him sternly.
"Come, why persist?" Seldonimov whispered to him. "Why, I was talking. Mayn't one speak?"
the latter protested in a whisper. But he said no more, and with secret fury walked out of the room. He made his way straight to the attractive little back room, where, for the benefit of the dancing gentlemen, vodka of two sorts, salt fish, caviar into slices, and a bottle of very strong sherry of Russian make had been set early in the evening on a little table, covered with a Yaroslav cloth. With anger in his heart, he was pouring himself out a glass of vodka, when suddenly the medical student with the dishevelled locks, the foremost dancer and cutter of capers at Seldonimov's ball, rushed in. He fell on the decanter with greedy haste.
"They're just going to begin," he said rapidly, helping himself. "Come and look. I'm going to dance a solo on my head. After supper I shall risk the fish dance. It is just the thing for the wedding. So to speak, a friendly hint to Seldonimov. She's a jolly creature, that Kleopatra Semyonovna. You can venture on anything you like with her."
"He's a reactionary," said the young man on the comic paper gloomily as he tossed off his vodka.
"Who's a reactionary?" "Why, the personage before whom they set those sweetmeats. He's a reactionary, I tell you."
"What nonsense," muttered the student, as he rushed out of the room, hearing the opening bars of the quadrille. Left alone, the young man on the comic paper poured himself out another glass to give himself more assurance and independence. He drank and ate a snack of something, and never had the actual civil councillor Ivan Ilyich made for himself a bitterer foe, more implacably bent on revenge than was the young man on the staff of the Firebrand, whom he had so slighted, especially after the latter had drunk two glasses of vodka. Alas, Ivan Ilyich suspected nothing of the sort. He did not suspect another circumstance of prime importance either, which had an influence on the mutual relations of the guests and His Excellency. The fact was that though he had given a proper and even detailed explanation of his presence at his clerk's wedding, this explanation did not really satisfy anyone, and the visitors were still embarrassed. But suddenly everything was transformed as though by magic. All were reassured and ready to enjoy themselves, to laugh, to shriek, to dance, exactly as though the unexpected visitor were not in the room. The cause of it was a rumour, a whisper, a report, which spread in some unknown way that the visitor was not quite, it seemed, was in fact, a little top-heavy. And though this seemed at first a horrible calumny, it began by degrees to appear to be justified. Suddenly everything became clear. What was more, they felt all at once extraordinarily free, and it was just at this moment that the quadrille, for which the medical student was in such haste, the last before supper, began. And just as Ivan Ilyich meant to address the bride again, intending to provoke her with some innuendo, the tall officer suddenly dashed up to her and, with a flourish, dropped on one knee before her. She immediately jumped up from the sofa and whisked off with him to take her place in the quadrille. The officer did not even apologize, and she did not even glance at the general as she went away. She seemed, in fact, relieved to escape. "After all, she has a right to be," thought Ivan Ilyich, "and of course they don't know how to behave."
"Don't you stand on ceremony, friend Porfiry," he said, addressing Seldonimov. "Perhaps you have arrangements to make or something. Please don't put yourself out." "Why does he keep guard over me?" he thought to himself. Seldonimov, with his long neck and his eyes fixed intently upon him, began to be insufferable. In fact, all this was not the thing, not the thing at all. But Ivan Ilyich was still far from admitting this. The quadrille began.
"Will you allow me, Your Excellency?"
asked Akim Petrovich, holding the bottle respectfully in his hands and preparing to pour from it into His Excellency's glass.
I really don't know whether...
But Akim Petrovich, with reverent and radiant face, was already filling the glass. After filling the glass, he proceeded, writhing and wriggling, as it were stealthily, as it were furtively, to pour himself out some, with this difference, that he did not fill his own glass to within a finger length of the top, and this seemed somehow more respectful. He was like a woman in travail as he sat beside his chief. What could he talk about, indeed? Yet to entertain His Excellency was an absolute duty, since he had the honour of keeping him company. The champagne served as a resource, and His Excellency too was pleased that he had filled his glass, not for the sake of the champagne, for it was warm and perfectly abominable, but just morally pleased. "The old chap would like to have a drink himself," thought Ivan Ilyich, "but he doesn't venture till I do. I mustn't prevent him. And indeed it would be absurd for the bottles to stand between us as untouched." He took a sip. Anyway, it seemed better than doing nothing. "I am here," he said, with pauses and emphasis. "I am here, you know, so to speak, accidentally. And, of course, it may be that some people would consider it unseemly for me to be at such a gathering." Akim Petrovich said nothing, but listened with timid curiosity. "But I hope you will understand with what object I have come. I haven't really come simply to drink wine." Akim Petrovich tried to chuckle, following the example of His Excellency, but again he could not get it out, and again he made absolutely no consolatory answer. "I am here in order, so to speak, to encourage, to show, so to speak, a moral aim," Ivan Ilyich continued, feeling vexed at Akim Petrovich's stupidity. But he suddenly subsided into silence himself. He saw that poor Akim Petrovich had dropped his eyes as though he were in fault. The general, in some confusion, made haste to take another sip from his glass, and Akim Petrovich clutched at the bottle as though it were his only hope of salvation, and filled the glass again. "You haven't many resources," thought Ivan Ilyich, looking sternly at poor Akim Petrovich. The latter, feeling that stern, general-like eye upon him, made up his mind to remain silent for good and not to raise his eyes. So they sat beside each other for a couple of minutes. 2 sickly minutes for Akim Petrovich. A couple of words about Akim Petrovich. He was a man of the old school, as meek as a hen, reared from infancy to obsequious servility, and at the same time a good-natured and even honourable man. He was a Petersburg Russian. That is, his father and his father's father were born, grew up, and served in Petersburg, and had never once left Petersburg. That is quite a special type of Russian. They have hardly any idea of Russia, though that does not trouble them at all. Their whole interest is confined to Petersburg, and chiefly the place in which they serve. All their thoughts are concentrated on preference for farthing points, on the shop and their month's salary. They don't know a single Russian custom, a single Russian song except Luchinushka, and that only because it is played on the barrel organs. However, there are 2 fundamental and invariable signs by which you can at once distinguish a Petersburg Russian from a real Russian. The first sign is the fact that Petersburg Russians, all without exception, speak of the newspaper as the academic news, and never call it the Petersburg news. The second and equally trustworthy sign is that Petersburg Russians never make use of the word breakfast, but always call it Frühstück, with special emphasis on the first syllable. By these radical and distinguishing signs you can tell them apart. In short, this is a humble type, which has been formed during the last 35 years. Akim Petrovich, however, was by no means a fool. If the general had asked him a question about anything in his own province, he would have answered and kept up a conversation. As it was unseemly for a subordinate even to answer such questions as these, though Akim Petrovich was dying from curiosity to know something more detailed about His Excellency's real intentions. And meanwhile, Ivan Ilyich sank more and more into meditation and a sort of whirl of ideas. In his absorption, he sipped his glass every half minute. Akim Petrovich at once zealously filled it up. Both were silent. Ivan Ilyich began looking at the dances, and immediately something attracted his attention. One circumstance even surprised him. The dances were certainly lively. Here people danced in the simplicity of their hearts to amuse themselves, and even to romp wildly. Among the dancers, few were really skilful, but the unskilled stamped so vigorously that they might have been taken for agile ones. The officer was among the foremost. He particularly liked the figures in which he was left alone to perform a solo. Then he performed the most marvellous capers. For instance, standing upright as a post, he would suddenly bend over to one side, so that one expected him to fall over. But with the next step, he would suddenly bend over in the opposite direction at the same acute angle to the floor. He kept the most serious face and danced in the full conviction that everyone was watching him. Another gentleman, who had had rather more than he could carry before the quadrille, dropped asleep beside his partner, so that his partner had to dance alone. The young registration clerk, who had danced with the lady in the blue scarf through all the figures and through all the five quadrilles which they had danced that evening, played the same prank the whole time. That is, he dropped a little behind his partner, seized the end of her scarf, and, as they crossed over, succeeded in imprinting some 20 kisses on the scarf. His partner sailed along in front of him as though she noticed nothing. The medical student really did dance on his head and excited frantic enthusiasm, stamping and shrieks of delight. In short, the absence of constraint was very marked. Ivan Ilyich, whom the wine was beginning to affect, began by smiling, but by degrees a bitter doubt began to steal into his heart. Of course he liked free and easy manners and unconventionality. He desired. He had even inwardly prayed for free and easy manners when they had all held back. But now that unconventionality had gone beyond all limits. One lady, for instance, the one in the shabby dark blue velvet dress, bought fourth hand, in the sixth figure, pinned her dress so as to turn it into something like trousers. This was the Cleopatra Semyonovna, with whom one could venture to do anything, as her partner, the medical student, had expressed it. The medical student defied description. He was simply a Fokin. How was it? They had held back, and now they were so quickly emancipated. One might think it nothing, but this transformation was somehow strange. It indicated something. It was as though they had forgotten Ivan Ilyich's existence. Of course, he was the first to laugh, and even ventured to applaud. Akim Petrovich chuckled respectfully in unison, though indeed with evident pleasure and no suspicion that His Excellency was beginning to nourish in his heart a new gnawing anxiety. "You dance capitally, young man," Ivan Ilyich was obliged to say to the medical student as he walked past him. The student turned sharply towards him, made a grimace, and, bringing his face close into unseemly proximity to the face of His Excellency, crowed like a cock at the top of his voice. This was too much. Ivan Ilyich got up from the table. In spite of that, a roar of inexpressible laughter followed, for the crow was an extraordinarily good imitation, and the whole performance was utterly unexpected. Ivan Ilyich was still standing in bewilderment when suddenly Pseldonimov himself made an appearance and, with a bow, began begging him to come to supper. His mother followed him. "Your Excellency," she said, bowing, "do us the honour. Do not disdain our humble fare. I "I really don't know," Ivan Ilyich was beginning. "I did not come with that idea. I meant to be going." He was, in fact, holding his hat in his hands. What is more, he had at that very moment taken an inward vow at all costs to depart at once, and on no account whatever to consent to remain. And he remained. A minute later, he led the procession to the table. Pseldonimov and his mother walked in front, clearing the way for him. They made him sit down in the seat of honour, and again a bottle of champagne, opened but not begun, was set beside his plate. By way of hors d'oeuvres, there were salt herrings and vodka. He put out his hand, poured out a large glass of vodka, and drank it off. He had never drunk vodka before. He felt as though he were rolling down a hill, were flying, 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 that he must stop himself, catch at something. But there was no possibility of it. His position was certainly becoming more and more eccentric. What is more, it seemed as though fate were mocking at him. God knows what had happened to him in the course of an hour or so. When he went in, he had, so to say, opened his arms to embrace all humanity, all his subordinates. And here, not more than an hour had passed, and in all his aching heart he felt and knew that he hated Pseldonimov and was cursing him, his wife, and his wedding. What was more, he saw from his face, from his eyes alone, that Pseldonimov himself hated him, that he was looking at him with eyes that almost said, "If only you would take yourself off, curse you, foisting yourself on us." All this he had read for some time in his eyes. Of course, as he sat down to table, Ivan Ilyich would sooner have had his hand cut off than to have owned, not only aloud, but even to himself, that this was really so. The moment had not fully arrived yet. There was still a moral vacillation. But his heart, it ached. It was clamouring for freedom, for air, for rest. Ivan Ilyich was really too good-natured. He knew, of course, that he ought long before to have gone away, not merely to have gone away, but to have made his escape, that all this was not the same, but had turned out utterly different from what he had dreamed of on the pavement. "Why did I come? Did I come here to eat and drink?" he asked himself as he tasted the salt herring. He even had attacks of scepticism. There was, at moments, a faint stir of irony in regard to his own fine action at the bottom of his heart. He actually wondered at times why he had come in. But how could he go away? To go away like this without having finished the business properly was impossible. What would people say? They would say that he was frequenting low company. Indeed, it really would amount to that if he did not end it properly. What would Stepan Nikiforovitch, Semyon Ivanovitch, say? For, of course, it would be all over the place by tomorrow. What would be said in the offices, at the Shembels, at the Shubins? No, he must take his departure in such a way that all should understand why he had come. He must make clear his moral aim. And meantime, the dramatic moment would not present itself. "They don't even respect me," he went on, thinking. "What are they laughing at? They are as free and easy as though they had no feeling. But I have long suspected that all the younger generation are without feeling. I must remain at all costs. They have just been dancing, but now, at table, they will all be gathered together. I will talk about questions, about reforms, about the greatness of Russia. I can still win their enthusiasm." Yes, perhaps nothing is yet lost. Perhaps it is always like this in reality. What should I begin upon with them to attract them? What plan can I hit upon? I'm lost, simply lost. And what is it they want? What is it they require? I see they are laughing together there. Can it be at me? Merciful heavens! But what is it I want? Why is it I am here? Why don't I go away? Why do I go on persisting? He thought this, and a sort of shame, a deep, unbearable shame, rent his heart more and more intensely. but everything went on in the same way, one thing after another. Just 2 minutes after he had sat down to the table, one terrible thought overwhelmed him completely. He suddenly felt that he was horribly drunk. That is, not as he was before, but hopelessly drunk. The cause of this was the glass of vodka which he had drunk after the champagne, and which had immediately produced an effect. He was conscious, he felt, in every fibre of his being, that he was growing hopelessly feeble. Of course, his assurance was greatly increased, but consciousness had not deserted him, and it kept crying out, "It is bad, very bad, and in fact utterly unseemly." Of course, his unstable, drunken reflections could not rest long on one subject. There began to be apparent, and unmistakably so, even to himself, two opposite sides. On one side, there was swaggering assurance, a desire to conquer, a disdain of obstacles, and a desperate confidence that he would attain his object. The other side showed itself in the aching of his heart, and a sort of gnawing in his soul. What would they say? How would it all end? What would happen tomorrow? Tomorrow. Tomorrow. He had felt vaguely before that he had enemies in the company. No doubt because I was drunk, he thought with agonizing doubt. What was his horror when he actually, by unmistakable signs, convinced himself now that he really had enemies at the table, and that it was impossible to doubt of it? And why? Why? He wondered. At the table, there were all the 30 guests, of whom several were quite tipsy. Others were behaving with a careless and sinister independence, shouting and talking at the top of their voices, bawling out the toasts before the time, and pelting the ladies with pellets of bread. One unprepossessing personage in a greasy coat had fallen off his chair as soon as he sat down, and remained so till the end of supper. Another one made desperate efforts to stand on the table, to propose a toast, and only the officer, who seized him by the tails of his coat, moderated his premature ardour. The supper was a pell-mell affair, although they had hired a cook who had been in the service of a general. There was the galantine, there was tongue and potatoes, there were rissoles with green peas, there was, finally, a goose, and last of all, blancmange. Among the drinks were beer, vodka, and sherry. The only bottle of champagne was standing beside the general, which obliged him to pour it out for himself, and also for Akim Petrovich, who did not venture at supper to officiate on his own initiative. The other guests had to drink the toasts in Caucasian wine, or anything else they could get. The table was made up of several tables put together, among them even a card table. It was covered with many tablecloths, amongst them one coloured Yaroslav cloth. The gentlemen sat alternately with the ladies. Pseldonimov's mother would not sit down to the table. She bustled about and supervised. But another sinister female figure, who had not shown herself till then, appeared on the scene, wearing a reddish silk dress with a very high cap on her head and a bandage round her face for toothache. It appeared that this was the bride's mother, who had at last consented to emerge from a back room for supper. She had refused to appear till then, owing to her implacable hostility to Pseldonimov's mother, but to that we will refer later. This lady looked spitefully, even sarcastically, at the general, and evidently did not wish to be presented to him. To Ivan Ilyich, this figure appeared suspicious in the extreme. But apart from her, several other persons were suspicious, and inspired involuntary apprehension and uneasiness. It even seemed that they were in some sort of plot together against Ivan Ilyich. At any rate, it seemed so to him, and throughout the whole supper he became more and more convinced of it. A gentleman with a beard, some sort of free artist, was particularly sinister. He even looked at Ivan Ilyich several times, and then, turning to his neighbour, whispered something. Another person present was unmistakably drunk, but yet, from certain signs, was to be regarded with suspicion. the medical student, too, gave rise to unpleasant expectations. Even the officer himself was not quite to be depended on, but the young man on the comic paper was blazing with hatred. He lolled in his chair. He looked so haughty and conceited. He snorted so aggressively. And though the rest of the guests took absolutely no notice of the young journalist who had contributed only 4 wretched poems to the Firebrand and had consequently become a liberal and evidently indeed disliked him, yet when a pellet of bread aimed in his direction fell near Ivan Ilyich, he was ready to stake his head that it had been thrown by no other than the young man in question. All of this, of course, had a pitiable effect on him. Another observation was particularly unpleasant. Ivan Ilyich became aware that he was beginning to articulate indistinctly and with difficulty, that he was longing to say a great deal, but that his tongue refused to obey him. And then he suddenly seemed to forget himself, and worst of all, he would suddenly burst into a loud guffaw of laughter, apropos of nothing. This inclination quickly passed off after a glass of champagne, which Ivan Ilyich had not meant to drink, though he had poured it out and suddenly drunk it quite by accident. After that glass, he felt at once almost inclined to cry. He felt that he was sinking into a most peculiar state of sentimentality. He began to be again filled with love. He loved everyone, even Pseldonimov, even the young man on the comic paper. He suddenly longed to embrace all of them, to forget everything, and to be reconciled. What is more, to tell them everything, openly, all, that is, to tell them what a good, nice man he was, with what wonderful talents, what services he would do for his country, how good he was at entertaining the fair sex, and, above all, how progressive he was, how humanely ready he was to be indulgent to all, to the very lowest. And finally, in conclusion, to tell them frankly all the motives that had impelled him to turn up at Pseldonimov's uninvited, to drink 2 bottles of champagne, and to make him happy with his presence. The truth, the holy truth and candour before all things. I will capture them by candour. They will believe me. I see it clearly. They actually look at me with hostility. But when I tell them all, I shall conquer them completely. They will fill their glasses and drink my health with shouts. The officer will break his glass on his spur. Perhaps they will even shout hurrah. Even if they want to toss me after the hussar fashion, I will not oppose them, and indeed it would be very jolly. I will kiss the bride on her forehead. She's charming. Akim Petrovich is a very nice man, too. Pseldonimov will improve, of course, later on. He will acquire, so to speak, a society polish. And although, of course, the younger generation has not that delicacy of feeling, yet I will talk to them about the contemporary significance of Russia among the European states. I will refer to the peasant question, too, yes. And they will all like me, and I shall leave with glory. These dreams were, of course, extremely agreeable, but what was unpleasant was that in the midst of these roseate anticipations, Ivan Ilyich suddenly discovered in himself another unexpected propensity, that was to spit. Anyway, saliva began running from his mouth apart from any will of his own. He observed this to Akim Petrovich, whose cheek he spluttered upon, and who sat, not daring to wipe it off from respectfulness. Ivan Ilyich took his dinner napkin and wiped it himself, but this immediately struck him himself as so incongruous, so opposed to all common sense, that he sank into silence and began wondering. Though Akim Petrovich emptied his glass, yet he sat as though he was scalded. Ivan Ilyich reflected now that he had, for almost a quarter of an hour, been talking to him about some interesting subject, but that Akim Petrovich had not only seemed embarrassed as he listened, but positively frightened. Pseldonimov, who was sitting one chair away from him, also craned his neck towards him, and, bending his head sideways, listened to him with the most unpleasant air. He actually seemed to be keeping a watch on him. Turning his eyes upon the rest of the company, he saw that many were looking straight at him and laughing. But what was strangest of all was that he was not in the least embarrassed by it. On the contrary, he sipped his glass again and suddenly began speaking so that all could hear.
"I was saying just now," he began as loudly as possible, "I was saying just now, ladies and gentlemen, to Akim Petrovich, that Russia, yes, Russia, in short, you understand that I mean to say, Russia is living. It is my profound conviction, through a period of humanity."
"Humanity," was heard at the other end of the table. "Too."
Ivan Ilyich stopped. Pseldonimov got up from his chair and began trying to see who had shouted. Akim Petrovich stealthily shook his head, as though admonishing the guests. Ivan Ilyich saw this distinctly, but in his confusion said nothing.
"Humanity," he continued obstinately. "And this evening, and only this evening, I said to Stepan Nikiforovich, yes, that the regeneration, so to speak, of things—"
"Your Excellency!"
was heard a loud exclamation at the other end of the table.
"What is your pleasure?"
answered Ivan Ilyich, pulling up short and trying to distinguish who had called to him.
"Nothing at all, Your Excellency. I was carried away. Continue! Continue!"
The voice was heard again. Ivan Ilyich felt upset.
"The regeneration, so to speak, of those same things—"
"Your Excellency!"
the voice shouted again.
"What do you want?
How do you do?"
This time Ivan Ilyich could not restrain himself. He broke off his speech and turned to the assailant who had disturbed the general harmony. He was a very young lad, still at school, who had taken more than a drop too much, and was an object of great suspicion to the general. He had been shouting for a long time past, and had even broken a glass and two plates, maintaining that this was the proper thing to do at a wedding. At the moment when Ivan Ilyich turned towards him, the officer was beginning to pitch into the noisy youngster.
"What are you about? Why are you yelling? We shall turn you out, that's what we shall do."
"I don't mean you, Your Excellency, I don't mean you. Continue,"
cried the hilarious schoolboy, lolling back in his chair.
"Continue, I'm listening. I'm very, very, very much pleased with you. Praiseworthy, praiseworthy."
"The wretched boy is drunk," said Pseldonimov in a whisper.
"I see he is drunk, but I was just telling a very amusing anecdote, Your Excellency," began the officer. "About a lieutenant in our company who was talking just like that to his superior officers. So this young man is imitating him now. To every word of his superior officers he said, 'Praiseworthy, praiseworthy.' He was turned out of the army 10 years ago on account of it."
"What lieutenant was that?"
"In our company, Your Excellency. He went out of his mind over the word praiseworthy. At first they tried gentle methods. Then they put him under arrest. His commanding officer admonished him in the most fatherly way, and he answered, 'Praiseworthy, praiseworthy.' And strange to say, the officer was a fine-looking man over 6 feet. They meant to court-martial him, but then they perceived that he was mad."
"So, a schoolboy. A schoolboy's prank need not be taken seriously. For my part, I am ready to overlook it."
"They held a medical inquiry, Your Excellency."
"Upon my word! But he was alive, wasn't he?"
"What, did they dissect him?"
A loud and almost universal roar of laughter resounded among the guests, who had till then behaved with decorum. Ivan Ilyich was furious.
"Ladies and gentlemen,"
he shouted, at first scarcely stammering.
"I am fully capable of apprehending that a man is not dissected alive. I imagined that in his derangement he had ceased to be alive. That is, that he had died. That is, I mean to say, that you don't like me. And yet I like you all. Yes, I like poor Porphyry. I am lowering myself by speaking like this."
At that moment, Ivan Ilyich spluttered, so that a great dab of saliva flew onto the tablecloth in a most conspicuous place. Pseldonimov flew to wipe it off with a table napkin. This last disaster crushed him completely.
"My friends, this is too much," he cried in despair.
"The man is drunk, Your Excellency," Pseldonimov prompted him again.
"Porphyry, I see that you all, yes, I say that I hope, yes, I call upon you all to tell me in what way have I lowered myself."
Ivan Ilyich was almost crying.
"Your Excellency, good heavens, Porphyry, I appeal to you. Tell me, when I came, yes, yes, to your wedding, I had an object. I was aiming at moral elevation. I wanted it to be felt. I appeal to all. Am I greatly lowered in your eyes or not?"
A death-like silence. That was just it. A death-like silence. And to such a downright question.
"They might at least shout at this minute," flashed through His Excellency's head.
But the guests only looked at one another. Akim Petrovich sat more dead than alive, while Pseldonimov, numb with terror, was repeating to himself the awful question which had occurred to him more than once already.
"What shall I have to pay for all this tomorrow?"
At this point, the young man on the comic paper, who was very drunk but who had hitherto sat in morose silence, addressed Ivan Ilyich directly, and with flashing eyes began answering in the name of the whole company.
"Yes," he said in a loud voice. "Yes, you have lowered yourself. Yes, you are a reactionary. Reactionary. Young man, you are forgetting yourself. To whom are you speaking so to express it?"
Ivan Ilyich cried furiously, jumping up from his seat again.
"To you. And secondly, I am not a young man. You've come to give yourself airs and try to win popularity."
"Pseldonimov, what does this mean?" cried Ivan Ilyich.
But Pseldonimov was reduced to such horror that he stood still like a post and was utterly at a loss what to do. The guests, too, sat mute in their seats, all but the artist and the schoolboy, who applauded and shouted, "Bravo! Bravo!" The young man on the comic paper went on shouting with unrestrained violence.
"Yes, you came to show off your humanity. You've hindered the enjoyment of everyone. You've been drinking champagne without thinking that it is beyond the means of a clerk at 10 rubles a month, and I suspect that you are one of those high officials who are a little too fond of the young wives of their clerks. What is more, I am convinced that you support state monopolies. Yes, yes, yes."
"Pseldonimov! Pseldonimov!"
shouted Ivan Ilyich, holding out his hands to him. He felt that every word uttered by the comic young man was a fresh dagger at his heart.
"Directly, Your Excellency. Please do not disturb yourself,"
Pseldonimov cried energetically, rushing up to the comic young man, seizing him by the collar and dragging him away from the table. Such physical strength could indeed not have been expected from the weakly-looking Pseldonimov. But the comic young man was very drunk, while Pseldonimov was perfectly sober. Then he gave him 2 or 3 cuffs in the back and thrust him out of the door.
"You're all scoundrels!"
roared the young man of the comic paper.
"I will caricature you all tomorrow in the Firebrand."
They all leapt from their seats.
"Your Excellency! Your Excellency!"
cried Pseldonimov, his mother, and several others crowding round the general.
"Your Excellency, do not be disturbed."
"No, no," cried the general. "I'm annihilated. I meant to bless you, so to speak. And this is how I am paid. For everything. Everything."
He sank onto a chair as though unconscious, laid both his arms on the table, and bowed his head over them, straight into a plate of blancmange. There is no need to describe the general horror. A minute later, he got up, evidently meaning to go out, gave a lurch, stumbled against the leg of a chair, fell full length on the floor, and snored. This is what is apt to happen to men who don't drink when they accidentally take a glass too much. They preserve their consciousness to the last point, to the last minute, and then fall to the ground as though struck down. Ivan Ilyich lay on the floor, absolutely unconscious. Pseldonimov clutched at his hair and sat as though petrified in that position. The guests made haste to depart, commenting each in his own way on the incident. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. The worst of it was that Pseldonimov's circumstances were far worse than could have been imagined, in spite of the unattractiveness of his present surroundings. And while Ivan Ilyich is lying on the floor and Pseldonimov is standing over him, tearing his hair in despair, we will break off the thread of our story and say a few explanatory words about Porfiry Petrovich Pseldonimov. Not more than a month before his wedding, he was in a state of hopeless destitution. He came from a province where his father had served in some department and where he had died while awaiting his trial on some charge. When, 5 months before his wedding, Pseldonimov, who had been in hopeless misery in Petersburg for a whole year before, got his berth at 10 rubles a month, he revived both physically and mentally, but he was soon crushed by circumstances again. There were only 2 Pseldonimovs left in the world, himself and his mother, who had left the province after her husband's death. The mother and son barely existed in the freezing cold, and sustained life on the most dubious substances. There were days when Pseldonimov himself went with a jug to the Fontanka for water to drink. When he got his place, he succeeded in settling with his mother in a corner. She took in washing, while for 4 months he scraped together every farthing to get himself boots and an overcoat. And what troubles he had to endure at his office! His superiors approached him with the question, how long was it since he had had a bath? There was a rumour about him that under the collar of his uniform there were nests of bugs, but Pseldonimov was a man of strong character. On the surface he was mild and meek. He had the merest smattering of education. He was practically never heard to talk of anything. I do not know for certain whether he thought, made plans and theories, had dreams, but on the other hand, there was being formed within him an instinctive, furtive, unconscious determination to fight his way out of his wretched circumstances. He had the persistence of an ant. Destroy an ant's nest, and they will begin at once re-erecting it. Destroy it again, and they will begin again without wearying. He was a constructive, house-building animal. One could see from his brow that he would make his way, would build his nest, and perhaps even save for a rainy day. His mother was the only creature in the world who loved him, and she loved him beyond everything. She was a woman of resolute character, hard-working and indefatigable, and at the same time good-natured. So perhaps they might have lived in their corner for 5 or 6 years till their circumstances changed, if they had not come across the retired titular councillor, Mlekopitaev, who had been a clerk in the treasury and had served at one time in the provinces, but had latterly settled in Petersburg and had established himself there with his family. He knew Pseldonimov, and had at one time been under some obligation to his father. He had a little money, not a large sum, of course, but there it was. How much it was no one knew, not his wife, nor his elder daughter, nor his relations. He had 2 daughters, and, as he was an awful bully, a drunkard, a domestic tyrant,
and in addition to that an invalid, he took it into his head one day to marry one of his daughters to Seldonimov.
"I knew his father," he would say. "He was a good fellow, and his son will be a good fellow."
Mlekopitaev did exactly as he liked. His word was law. He was a very queer bully. For the most part, he spent his time sitting in an armchair, having lost the use of his legs from some disease, which did not, however, prevent him from drinking vodka. For days together he would be drinking and swearing. He was an ill-natured man. He always wanted to have someone whom he could be continually tormenting, and for that purpose he kept several distant relations, his sister, a sickly and peevish woman, two of his wife's sisters, also ill-natured and very free with their tongues, and his old aunt, who had, through some accident, a broken rib. He kept another dependent also, a Russianized German, for the sake of her talent for entertaining him with stories from the Arabian Nights. His sole gratification consisted in jeering at all these unfortunate women and abusing them every minute with all his energies, though the latter, not excepting his wife, who had been born with toothache, dared not utter a word in his presence. He set them at loggerheads at one another, inventing and fostering spiteful backbiting and dissensions among them, and then laughed and rejoiced seeing how they were ready to tear one another to pieces. He was very much delighted when his elder daughter, who had lived in great poverty for 10 years with her husband, an officer of some sort, and was at last left a widow, came to live with him with 3 little sickly children. He could not endure her children, but as her arrival had increased the material upon which he could work his daily experiments, the old man was very much pleased. All these ill-natured women and sickly children, together with their tormentor, were crowded together in a wooden house on Petersburg side, and did not get enough to eat, because the old man was stingy, and gave out to them money a farthing at a time, though he did not grudge himself vodka. They did not get enough sleep, because the old man suffered from sleeplessness, and insisted on being amused. In short, they were all in misery, and cursed their fate. It was at that time that Mlekopitaev's eye fell upon Seldonimov. He was struck by his long nose and submissive air. His weakly and unprepossessing younger daughter had just reached the age of 17. Though she had at one time attended a German school, she had acquired scarcely anything but the alphabet. Then she grew up rickety and anemic, in fear of her crippled, drunken father's crutch, in a bedlam of domestic backbiting, eavesdropping and scolding. She had never had any friends or any brains. She had for a long time been eager to be married. In company she sat mute, but at home with her mother and the women of the household she was spiteful and cantankerous. She was particularly fond of pinching and smacking her sister's children, telling tales of their pilfering bread and sugar, and this led to endless and implacable strife with her elder sister. Her old father himself offered her to Seldonimov. Miserable as the latter's position was, he yet asked for a little time to consider. His mother and he hesitated for a long time, but with the young lady there was to come as dowry a house, and, though it was a nasty little wooden house of one story, yet it was property of a kind. Moreover, they would give with her 400 rubles, and how long it would take to save it up himself.
"What am I taking the man into my house for?" shouted the drunken bully. "In the first place, because you are all females, and I'm sick of female society. I want Seldonimov, too, to dance to my piping, for I am his benefactor. And in a second place, I am doing it because you are all cross and don't want it, so I'll do it to spite you. What I have said. And you beat her, Porfiry, when she is your wife. She has been possessed of 7 devils ever since she was born. You beat them out of her, and I'll get the stick ready."
Seldonimov made no answer, but he was already decided. Before the wedding, his mother and he were taken into the house, washed, clothed, provided with boots and money for the wedding. The old man took them under his protection, possibly just because the whole family was prejudiced against them. He positively liked Pseldonimov's mother, so that he actually restrained himself and did not jeer at her. On the other hand, he made Pseldonimov dance the Cossack dance a week before the wedding.
"Well, that's enough. I only wanted to see whether you remembered your position before me or not," he said at the end of the dance.
He allowed just enough money for the wedding, with nothing to spare, and invited all his relations and acquaintances. On Pseldonimov's side, there was no one but the young man who wrote for the Firebrand and Akim Petrovich, the guest of honour. Pseldonimov was perfectly aware that his bride cherished an aversion for him, and that she was set upon marrying the officer instead of him. But he put up with everything. He had made a compact with his mother to do so. The old father had been drunk and abusive and foul-tongued the whole of the wedding day and during the party in the evening. The whole family took refuge in the back rooms and were crowded there to suffocation. The front rooms were devoted to the dance and the supper. At last, when the old man fell asleep, dead drunk at 11 o'clock, the bride's mother, who had been particularly displeased with Pseldonimov's mother that day, made up her mind to lay aside her wrath, become gracious, and join the company. Ivan Ilyich's arrival had turned everything upside down. Madame Mlekopitaev was overcome with embarrassment, and began grumbling that she had not been told that the general had been invited. She was assured that he had come uninvited, but was so stupid as to refuse to believe it. Champagne had to be got. Pseldonimov's mother had only 1 ruble, while Pseldonimov himself had not 1 farthing. He had to grovel before his ill-natured mother-in-law, to beg for the money for 1 bottle and then for another. They pleaded for the sake of his future position in the service, for his career. They tried to persuade her. She did at last give from her own purse, but she forced Pseldonimov to swallow such a cupful of gall and bitterness that more than once he ran into the room where the nuptial couch had been prepared, and madly clutched at his hair, and trembling all over with impotent rage, he buried his head in the bed destined for the joys of paradise. No, indeed. Ivan Ilyich had no notion of the price paid for the 2 bottles of Jackson he had drunk that evening. What was the horror, the misery, and even the despair of Pseldonimov when Ivan Ilyich's visit ended in this unexpected way? He had a prospect again of no end of misery, and perhaps a night of tears and outcries from his peevish bride, and upbraidings from her unreasonable relations. Even apart from this, his head ached already, and there was dizziness and mist before his eyes. And here Ivan Ilyich needed looking after. At 3 o'clock at night, he had to hunt for a doctor or a carriage to take him home. And a carriage it must be, for it would be impossible to let an ordinary cabbie take him home in that condition.